good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this, the ninth ordinary meeting of the 174th session of the Queen's University Belfast Literary and Scientific Society. My name's Ryan Hoey, and as you can see from the slide, I am the Supreme Emperor of the Lyrific for this evening. So as Matthew has said, tonight we're here to debate the motion this House would leave the European Convention on Human Rights. But before we get to that, we have council announcements. So the first council announcement I have is obviously this Thursday we are going to Dublin to debate with the Phil on the motion this House would unite Ireland. And we've got a complimentary bus service for anyone who's a paid-up member of the Literific. You need to fill in the form on our social media to avail of that service, and also pay the £5 membership fee if you haven't already. So you can talk to Jamie at the end if you need to pay your membership fee, and you also need to sign up on the form. And I think there's only like 8 spaces left on the bus, so do that if you haven't already. The second announcement I have is that years ago in the society, when I first joined, if you swore in a debate, you had to give a bottle of port to the president at the next ordinary meeting. And using my newfound authority, I'm going to bring this rule back for one time only. So if you swear tonight, I will be finding you a bottle of port, which you have to bring to me at the next ordinary meeting of the society. Do we have any other council announcements?
Obviously.
Ellie.
Hi bitches, I'm back. I mean, do you think I can afford anything right now? I'm a broke bitch.
Like, making notes of who's swearing.
you can have me in debt all you like, you're not getting any. So I'm back. I took a week off. Then I forced Matthew to take a night off because mental health. It is really important, guys. Sorry I missed last week, but I did need to take a time for mental health. You were here when I spoke the week before. We can all see I was on the verge of a mental breakdown, I think. The fact that my hair is now a completely different length and colour, I think, is also shown. Because I did cut this at 3 a.m. in my bathroom, but it turned out well. Anyway, so next week is our Godkin debate, our freshers competition. We have 10 people doing it, which is fucking amazing. So, you know, like, so many new members did it, I'm really, really proud. Because we have so many members, we are going to have to hold the first round on the Monday night. That will just be the training night. Further details of the training night to come, that's James's business, not mine. But the actual Godkin pre-round, I will list those who are doing it in a minute, is going to be on Monday at 8 p.m. in the Peter Froggatt Centre, okay? The room will be announced on the page later in the next 2 days. We're just having an issue with room booking, but that will all be announced. So 8 p.m, if you're doing the Godkin, that will be then. That is the enlightenment. If you get through to the next round, that will be the Thursday that we will all witness, and that you will be told the motion on the night if you get through to the round for Thursday. So Thursday's debate is not disclosed yet, actually. So the names of those who I need A, confirmation, and B, confirmation they can make Monday is Jacqueline Bonner, Megan Hewitt, Ethan McCartney, Luke McGuire, Owen Usher, Noah Barnley, Jack Hanlon, and Dermot Hamill, and Katie Hughes as well. So if you could all just let me know that you are coming to Godkin on the Monday, and I will send you all the details. And then following on from that, I'm sorry I'm taking so much time here, but you know, I may as well since you beat me to the fucking chair. Anyway, if it had been a physical fight, I'd be in that chair, but anyway. So the week after is this House of Make Language Learning Compulsory. I need sign-ups for the opposition. So if you're against language learning like me and you were forced to do French GCSE despite the fact you can't speak a word of fucking French, sign up for that one. I'm sorry, I'm just not good with languages. Anyway, sign up for that one. You should all have me on Instagram at this point, Ellie Byrne, or you can message the pages. Okay, well, I've got one sign up, I need 2 more. That is all for me. I'm going to shut up and sit down now. Thank you all.
After the amount of swearing in that announcement, I think you now owe me a Land Rover or something. So, do we have any other council announcements?
I just more so as a bit of advice for anyone debating. As you can tell, my voice isn't as right as it normally is. For anyone that does over the next few weeks, it is winter time, end up with a sore throat. I give advice, honey, lemon, whiskey. As someone that basically spent Sunday night working in a bar, unable to speak, I'm in a much better, you know, situation than I was then. So honey, lemon, and whiskey is the best advice any debater will ever get.
I agree.
Is that all for council announcements? I think so. So now we move to everyone's favourite bit of the evening, which is of course the minute. So do you want to hear some minutes?
Yeah. Yeah.
Madam Secretary.
Hello everyone, Supreme Emperor Brian. Great to have you all here tonight. Thank you all for coming on a Tuesday evening. And I really do hope you enjoy the minutes, although this was a long debate, but very enjoyable to write up, but I did try to get it down as much as possible, so hold tight. So, on the 10th of November 2022, the Queen's University Belfast Literary and Scientific Society convened for the 8th ordinary meeting of the 174th session for the motion, "This House Would Rather Live in 1984 Than Brave New World." As usual, the meeting began with announcements. Tausha McSparran announced that she would be acting internal convener and for the speakers to confirm their spaces in the upcoming debates. After a reading of the minutes, the meeting moved to private members' business. Keira Spell, HLM, presented the American midterm election. Responses were heard by Noah Barnley, James Orchard, HLM, Adam Race, Daniel McCormick, Dermot Hamill, Tom Burns, John Lavery, Ryan Hoey, HLM, and Luke Maguire. President's questions then commenced. James Orchin, HLM, presented the story of a town in England being terrorised by a bird. He asked the president if he could be any animal to attack spectators, what would he be? The president said that he would be a Dermot Hamill. After president's questions, the vote of prior opinion was held. There were 21 votes for aye, 17 votes for nay, and 22 abstentions, so the proposition had it. First on the proposition was Jack Hanlon. Jack first argued that the government in 1984 is inherently weak, as it must read the thoughts of the citizens in order to oppress the opposition. Brave New World, however, is a far more dangerous form of oppression, as it represents the creeping hand of the government hidden behind pleasure and self-indulgence. Pleasures in the world of 1984 are real. Only through the theft of joy is it truly enjoyed. First in the opposition for their maiden speech was Megan Hewitt. She first argued that the consumption of happy drugs and bountiful sex fests were far better than torture and fear presented in 1984. No. Megan stated that Brave New World keeps everyone happy so that they would never want to leave, ultimately being a future that the Liberals want. Megan stated that she would rather be blissfully unaware and happy, and if you don't like it, you can always move outside of the wall. Second on the proposition was Cormac McSparran. He argued that we live in a present tense culture that forgets history, reflecting the painless self-indulgence of Brave New World. 1984, however, parallels the oppressive regimes of Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia. In 1984, the people are controlled through surveillance and pain. However, in Brave New World, the people are controlled by inflicting pleasure, playing on something we all love. With the historical cases cited previously, Cormac asked the House which is more likely to be a reality. Second on the opposition, giving her maiden speech, was Georgia Connolly. Georgia turned her attention to the ways in which women were treated in both books, stating that in 1984, women are presented as lacking both brains and agency. In Brave New World, however, Huxley somewhat predicted the emergence of women's bodily autonomy. The introduction of contraception and the removal of religious beliefs from this utopia ultimately eliminating the stigma around female promiscuity. Third on the proposition, giving her its maiden speech, was Thomas McCormack. Thomas presented how both characters are deeply troubled, neither able to fit in the worlds that they live in. Every private act perpetrated by Winston in 1984 is a defiance against the party, and in Brave New World, Bernard yearns for a different form of love. However, 1984 reflects an authoritative dictatorship, one which throughout history has ultimately collapsed. Third on the opposition, giving his maiden speech, was Terence Metcalfe. Terence first explained how he had actually experienced living in 1984, and it was not the fictional horror show depicted in the novel. There were no thought police, telescreens, or fear of being vaporized. In Brave New World, however, there is no hunger, poverty, war, or disease. He stated that only a sadistic reader would argue to live in the world of 1984. The final speaker for the proposition was Tulsa McSparran. Tulsa stated that Orwell's background of holding conservative views, his narrative of an almost socialist society may be negatively skewed. In 1984, the characters are given the opportunity to fight against the regime. However, in Brave New World, the use of drugs and the facade of contentness means that these people cannot be humans with opposing ideologies. The final speaker for the proposition was Kira Swale HLM. Kira presented how we all want to be heroes. However, there is a time in our lives in which we must realize this cannot always be the case. In 1984, every character is in a state of constant paranoia, in which if you are sure of your own mind, you are tortured and made into a puppet of the state. In Brave New World, however, every negative emotion is cured by drugs, is existing in happiness rather than suffering, trying to change a world they cannot. Questions were heard from James Orchin, HLM, and Dermot Hamill. Following the debate and questions from the House, the vote of speaker ability took place. There were 21 votes for the proposition, 37 votes for the opposition, and 2 abstentions, so the opposition had it. May I take the minutes as read?
Aye.
And now we move to everyone's actual favourite bit of the evening, which is private members' business. So, do we have any pieces of private members' business? Half to go to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are at war. Any thoughts on the NATO attack or the attack? The Russian attack on NATO's of Poland NATO. Any thoughts?
Please state your name for the minutes.
Noah Barnley. Obviously, it's awful what they're doing, but I must like to point out France has already surrendered, so we don't need to bother.
State your name for the minutes, please.
Dermot Hamill. I think it's absolutely awful. It's awful that people are being attacked and the threat of war now is over. But as someone that lives technically within the UK, I look weird in a uniform, so I welcome this.
Please state your name for the minutes.
Daniel McCormick. Not to sort of piss on your typical conservative warmongering, but we're not actually at war yet. Yeah. Apparently it was just a mistake. For those of you who haven't heard, two Russian missiles landed in Poland and killed 2 people. And whether or not NATO are actually going to declare war determines whether or not Dermot gets to get his uniform or not. So everyone cross their fingers and hope.
Please stay now for minutes.
Ellie Byrne. Just a further on, it was actually a fragment of a missile that landed in Russia and killed people, so none of the actual missiles were aimed at Poland, it was fragments were golf and hit them, so we are still hopefully not 100%, okay, sorry, I've got my fact checker beside me. Three different accounts, but hopefully it is the account where it's a broken thing, because we do not want to go to war.
Please stay now for the minutes.
Terence Medcalf, this seems to be a bit of a problem with Russia back in 1905, which I did not live through. It was the Russo-Japanese War, and the Russians decided to take their entire fleet from the Baltic and round to fight the Japanese on the other side of the world. While they were passing through the English Channel, they decided that some fishing stacks out of Folkestone were in fact Japanese long-range torpedo boats and promptly sank them. There was no war then. I don't think there's going to be a war now.
Please stay in 8 minutes.
Gary, so does anyone here knows what the Hoi Four is after Violet Four? Yeah. If you know the game, I can't wait for Hoi Five about World War III. I'm doing this.
Stay in 8 minutes, please.
Joe Murray. One thing is, this is not exactly like our little thing. Poland can just march in themselves and do whatever, but ultimately there has been an attack on their territory, people are dead, they couldn't go about it before him, but even if it is an accident,
Please state your name for a minute.
I'm Christopher Lynch. This isn't a solid source, but a group tracking right now just says that in Poland and NATO are considering it as a stray, which means we're not considering it a direct attack on Poland. But I think this is a result of the fact that Russia has used all of its precise munitions and is now just firing artillery from like World War II. And it's just
any other points on this? Any other pieces of private members' business? Please state your name for minutes.
Hello, my name is Kira Swale, and I've been deemed worthy of giving a statement by our Lord and Savior James Orchin. And he says, and I quote, "I'm currently in London, that den of liberalism." This to be a direct quote, by the way. "I now support a united Ireland."
Any thoughts on James's conversion?
I just want to comment on what James published. For those of you who didn't see it, James took some literary in-jokes and various other things, and he put them into like some AI thing, and he put up this thing. It's like, oh, it's pages long, this thing, right? Where it's just full of just, it's an AI-generated literific meeting. And I just want to vehemently object to the way that I portrayed it. In one page, I portrayed this, like, this weird, stereotypical cult sheet. And in another, I portrayed as a drunk, like, and I just want to say, there's a lot more sides to me than my junkie side and culture side.
I just want to say I found it highly accurate.
Please stay in there for minutes.
Jack Hammond, I just want to build on that a wee bit. If somebody thinks that you're Daniel or a culture, there's seriously no hope for the rest of us.
Why have you been your culture on a podcast? You denied it for 3 years
in a podcast.
Please stay in it for minutes.
No, finally. I must say, I quite enjoyed the discourse that came from the AI generated literary. I personally would love to see that debate actually done in real life.
My favourite bit of it is the fact that it has Kira saying, "Right, lads." Very on character. We'll go back.
Yeah, I actually got some vague insight into how this was generated. So essentially, according to James Orchin, how it works is you give the AI like basic information about the people you want in it. So with me, apparently he said that I start every sentence with "Right, lads. I'm ginger. I'm centre left. And I was also hit by a car." So that's a bit of insight into why such statements as "lol, I was hit by a car" were stated by me in said extract. But yeah, if you've any issue with how you were portrayed, it's probably directly due to James's instructions that said AI. So have fun.
Please state name for minutes.
I don't know. I'd just like to read out a quote from one of the joint private members' business, and it says, "The president came to me and it said, I was speaking, there's been a lot of talk about rats on Donnybrook." The Minister for the Environment, Jim Allister, has announced he will be personally training several hawks to patrol the area and take out the rats. Now, there was a couple of responses, but there was one from the President of Ireland, Daniel McCormick, which responded, "Have we considered giving the effects of giving either the rats or hawks LSD?"
Please stay in there for the minutes.
Christopher Lynch, for both of us, lots of Northern Ireland, can you define what a culture is?
I mean, as someone who's not from Northern Ireland, no. But anyone who is from Northern Ireland can do.
Essentially, if you're not from Belfast, you're a culture.
Please state your name for a minute.
So, I knew the rattle up to something. Ah! The rats are coming! And they're going to eat me alive! How did they come up to it, this?
Oh yeah, here's the thing. Like, apparently, according to James Orchin, he had to run the AI multiple times and kind of put a mishmash of various weird statements together. So yeah, he put decent effort into this. Whether it's necessary is all to debate.
Do we have any bits of private members that are not on James Orchard or is that
right? Right, so, not gonna do a bit self-promotion at the on that point, Literific Radio Show where I talk shit about debates and will be out at Christmas. It's very entertaining. But I talk a lot about the jungle on it, so I'm gonna bring up the jungle now. So I'm sorry, I actually don't I'm a big fan of the jungle. So obviously I've been watching Angus and Leia, and we've all seen that Matt Hancock is on it. And to give you a spoiler, he's finally not doing a fucking trial, thank God. But what do we think about it, and what do we think about him being voted by the public for camp leader, considering everything?
I mean, in this position, I shouldn't express an opinion. But I'd say that he's doing quite well objectively, I think, on the trials, but whether that makes him a good human being or not is something else.
Point of order. You're delving far too much into the political here. I can't stand it.
Put up with it. Please state your name for the minutes.
Owen Usher. So the marriage between UK politics and entertainment is now complete. Be ready for at least one cabinet minister of every substitute government to do some sort of, reality TV. Personally holding out for Theresa May to distribute.
Please state your name for the minutes.
Noah Barnley. Honestly, I do find it quite funny that the public is picking on him to do lots of challenges, and I've only watched a few clips, but seeing him eat a camel penis was genuinely one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
Please say it out for a minute.
I think it represents something slightly sinister, because while yes, it's very funny watching Matt Hancock get exposed to those insects and that kind of thing, this is very much an attempt at rehabilitation for a man who saw, who lorded over a health service and saw thousands of people die during the pandemic. It's a man that had an affair behind his wife's back while purporting to all of us how we shouldn't, you know, be making physical contact with people during the pandemic. I think it's disgusting. I think it's very much him attempting to rehabilitate his image while taking a massive paycheck, all while being a sitting MP.
Please state your name for the minute.
Ellie Byrne. I would like to second that. I think the man should be in a jail cell, not the jungle. Considering, you know, the report is coming out that he is responsible for over 150,000 deaths. But if we move on from that slightly, I mean, it's got me bloody side with Boy George, who, let's not forget, was in prison not that long ago for chaining a model and beating him with a chain to a radiator. And, you know, it's got me, yeah, Boy George was in prison for that. So, I mean, the jungle selection, I mean, we've got someone done for DEI, we've got someone who cheated on their partner in Strictly, we've got someone who cheated on their partner in Parliament and also is the cause of deaths. Then we've also got someone who chain and model to a radio or medium, so I don't think there's much election people on I'm a Celeb right now, but they're just getting criminals instead.
It's almost as if people only go on it when their careers are at the depths of their lowest point. Please state your name for the minute.
Jamie Warren. So I'm going to be in only the minority of people in this answer, but Matt Hancock, as an individual, I don't think you should level so much blame for the death of however many tens of thousands of people as a result of COVID. If Labour were in government, if Liberal Democrats were in government, there would always be people that would say mistakes were going to be made. The COVID-19 pandemic was an unprecedented occurrence or phenomenon. You could not foresee it. Yes, fair enough. In the time, there was one rule for the Conservative Party, one rule for other people, and I understand the sort of right that people have to be indifferent about that. You cannot hold one single person responsible for that. You have to understand politics more widely. Hold the government to account, not Matt Hancock.
Please stay now for a minute.
Harry Shaw, just going off that point, I think that Matt Hancock is using getting dirty to clean up his image. All the stuff's being flipped up on TikTok and whatever is obviously like PR sound bites, such as like, oh, I fell in love, I made a mistake, I messed up, and now I fessed up, now I messed up. You know, those things that are just going viral and trying to help, you know, bring him back into the political spotlight again.
Please state your name for a minute.
I think even though you're trying to accept the problem, I think you're also forgetting this is the same person that was also caught selling PPE contracts to his friends and his family. So he didn't just, you know, make a mistake and kill a bunch of people. He was literally sitting there puppeteering, so genuinely just enjoy your board, but fuck Matt Hancock.
At least stay there for the minutes.
Jack Cramley, just on that point as well, about all boards with like Labour were in power or the Democrat. They weren't. It was Matt Hancock. There needs to be a accountability taken by somebody, and if it's got to be him, it'll be fucking him.
Please stay there for the minutes.
I think maybe your comment, Jamie, is a wee bit. Being a wee bit misunderstood, as far as I can see. He was in the position, so he bears some level of responsibility. And being the figurehead, he bears some level of responsibility. For example, when Johnson was overseeing it, you know, he was in charge, and that they had a heap of parties. And even though he wasn't at all of them, he was in a lot of them, but he wasn't at all of them. He's still the figurehead, and he kind of takes a lot of the heat for that. Matt Hancock should take a lot of the heat for the fuck up during COVID because he lied about it, and a lot of people died. But I think the real thing that people are angry about, and really, really angry about, is that they abided by guidance that he put forward while, you know, they had loved ones dying, and he just wanted to shift, and so he just turned around and was like, hey, and ignored the guidance. You know what I mean? And at that point, that really, really pisses people off, is when he's ignoring the rules that they followed to their own detriment. And I think that's where his massive hypocrisy and the fuck up is, you know?
So, in response to that, yes, there's hypocrisy, but you cannot morally say that one person is responsible for the deaths of so many people. You might want to level your anger at that, but that is not fair. Personally, I do not believe that that is fair. Just because someone was in that position at that time does not necessarily mean that you have to demonize him specifically. You can broadly express your anger at the Tory party, but that man does not deserve the 100% of the vitriol. You need to look at the bigger picture.
I think we'll now move on to what surely will not be my favourite part of the night, which is President's questions. So, do we have any questions for
him? Everyone, put your hand up!
I think I'm required to go to you.
Mr. President. Mr. Acting President.
Mr. Supreme Emperor.
What did you have for breakfast? I think I'm the only president to ever ask a president's questions, by the way.
A sitting president, yeah. But in terms of this morning I had caviar and champagne. No, I don't. I actually had a fry up, which was very nice, with bacon and eggs and sausage and beans and mushrooms and what else?
Put your hands up.
Come on.
Right. Okay. Go on.
Can I ask two?
No.
All right. Okay. Why they're in the council group chat?
No.
I'm bringing this up. There was a joke that you would come and try. The message itself was deleted. So of one council member asked you before I could screenshot my rage and that. But all council members are witnesses. Yeah. You were asked to be in drag, and you said yes. So is this your drag outfit?
Well, it didn't arrive in the post in time, unfortunately.
You have makeup.
We're a dragon Thursday.
Will do.
I definitely
brought makeup. Go ahead. Late name for the minutes.
Noah Barnley. Would you rather fuck Jim Shannon or Jim Allison?
Good lad.
Having met both of them, I'd go for Jim Shannon. That is the official position of the society.
Sort of the late hours of the 12th of September or the early hours of the 13th of September of this year, we were in a dodgy French nightclub. Would you care to recollect the quality of the indoor smoking room?
Yes, it was very good because they had a like closed off room where you could smoke in, which I prefer to being outside. So yes, it was very good and we should bring that here. And that's not a political opinion, that's just a fact.
Looking forward to your conscription of coming to the area to buy something.
I didn't catch that, what did you say?
Are you looking forward to your conscription that's going to come to the area to buy something?
I'm going to conscientiously object.
Mr. President, I last night had the misfortune
to attend Scratch Mondays and Lumberjack Sands. And I would like to point out that, in my opinion, it was the worst club night I've ever been to. I was once assaulted in a club. Mr. President, what in your opinion is the best club night in Belfast?
I guess I'm gonna have to go for Kremlin, but that is a very you know, sort of obvious answer.
I just wanted you said, given your previous now sealed political opinion, just could you say for us all vehemently and with spirit, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna.
Please. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Yeah.
As another British man taking a bar on the island of Ireland, do you feel like your ancestors are smiling at you?
Yeah. I actually intended to, and I did message you about going, but I'm just too exhausted. I actually haven't left the flat until this evening, since we went to Union Bar on Friday, so, yeah.
Just following on. Very good.
Does anyone else have any questions?
No.
Right, we're going to go for you, and then...
Just following on from Roisin's question, I suppose it's necessary to ask, why do you hate women?
What was your question?
Oh, mine was worse. So.
Ask it, Martin.
No.
I was just gonna. Dermot and I have had a chat, right? And we want to extend the person's question by 5 minutes. So I'm gonna propose it. Dermot, you're gonna
let it say.
So we're gonna have a vote to extend.
Although we have that many questions.
Oh, we do. We do.
Put your hands up. Don't do five minutes more.
Four, five, six, hey, six,
that's fast. That's fast.
Stop the point.
Pass with 22.
You got 5 more minutes.
Does anyone else have any? Go ahead.
I've got to ask two things. One, how do you feel about democracy in this moment in time? Two, how's the road?
I'll answer the last question first. It feels more ridiculous than I thought it would feel. Because I think it suits Matthew very well, whereas I don't know how I look at it, but it feels ridiculous. And on the second question, political neutrality, I will invoke that. Right, go ahead.
Would you rather fuck Tony Blair or Gordon Brown?
That is like the easiest question. I would rather fuck Tony Blair.
What? I didn't know you were
that. That was not what any of us were expecting.
Yeah. But I mean, just objectively, is a better looking man.
He did have a better haircut in lockdown, to be fair.
And, yeah. Go ahead.
I had the misfortune a few weeks ago having to travel to London.
That's a very big misfortune.
How does that involve a trip from Luton Airport? Generally engaging in London things. Mr. President, I'd like to ask you, why are English people the way they are?
I'm trying to think of a way of answering that without being too political, and I can't think of one.
Quiet!
What's your answer, Kenny?
I'm trying to think of a way to answer that isn't political, and I can't think of one.
Think of a way to put your challenge just for this one.
Go ahead.
Okay, so, hypothetically, you have to speak one of our Celtic commoner languages for the rest of your life. Which would it be? Irish, Welsh, or Scottish?
It would be Irish, because my family... Because my family is originally from Donegal, the best county in Ireland, and...
Fuck you,
and I actually am probably one of the only people in here who's spoken Irish in a literific debate, probably other than yourself, so there we go. Any other... We'll go to the main man himself, Terence.
Thank you, yes. I am going to be suffering the same fate as my friend from South Armagh in a few weeks' time. Do you have any advice for me on going to London for the first time in 3 decades? I'm trembling with anxiety.
Don't smile at people, don't try and spark up a conversation with people. Just socially isolate yourself from everyone and you'll be fine.
Also, the Airport Express train don't get it. A single is 25 quid and a single on the Underground is about a quid. Have fun, I failed, so you shan't.
Please state your name for the minutes.
Ellie Bird. Would you rather?
End this now or not?
Whoa, no.
I'm sorry. Suck Jim Alistair's mouth. Or Boris Johnson's.
That's an easy answer.
That's it.
Come on.
Am I allowed to say both? And with that, we move to the vote. I've taken so many.
There's two more, go.
Right.
This is your third one.
I've been in the discussion outside about four MILF prime ministers.
What?
Margaret Thatcher, Liz Truss, Gordon Brown. That is not my question. My question is, who do you think that a sexier Thatcher, Gillian Anderson or Meryl Streep?
I'm gonna go for Meryl Streep. Was that a question in Irish?
You know,
Was that a question in Irish?
Yes,
I can't speak Irish, unfortunately.
I
no, I've spoken Irish, but I can't actually speak Irish. Right. Is that everyone's present's questions? Can we please eventually move on to this goal? I will say that President's questions, as someone who has a very good knowledge of the standing orders of the society, President's questions is strictly limited to 10 minutes in the official constitution of the society, so I'm now ending it here. And we are now moving on to the vote on prior opinion. So, the motion is, this House would leave the European Convention on Human Rights. As many of that opinion, please raise your hand now. Anyone who thinks we shouldn't leave the European Convention on Human Rights, please raise your hand now.
Quiet!
What a bunch of chants.
And anyone who wants to abstain on the motion, please raise your hand now. I'm terrible. Josie, can we please have the result of the motion, please?
There were 8 votes for aye, 32 votes for nay, and 16 abstentions. So currently the opposition have it.
And it's now my great pleasure to welcome the first speaker for the proposition, Jamie Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Acting President. I want to start off my speech for the proposition this evening by highlighting a key benefit to leaving the ECHR, European Convention on Human Rights. And as a disclaimer, this is an unashamedly unionist United Kingdom perspective on the European Convention on Human Rights. However, it will in part more broadly apply to any country where there has been a debate about leaving the European Convention on Human Rights. As mentioned, key benefit of leaving the ECHR and distancing ourselves from Strasbourg is the ability to deport foreign criminals. Notable examples of where the ECHR has been abused to the advantage of foreign criminals residing in the UK in order to avoid extradition to those of Abu Hamza and Abu Qatada, both of whom were charged with committing acts of terrorism abroad, but time and time again managed to avoid this extradition for long periods by invoking the ECHR. The court argument in favour of leaving the ECHR we on the proposition are putting forward is one of conscience and morality. Despite being drafted in the aftermath of the horrors of the Second World War, ECHR has done little to deter countries such as the Russian Federation from changing their attitudes when it comes to human rights. The opposition will try to create a fallacious narrative that around a country leaving the ECHR is being unprecedented, and as such, its outcome would be difficult to predict. However, I want to press the House this evening with the notion that the benefits of the UK and any other country wanting to gain greater autonomy with regards to protecting its own citizens and leaving the ECHR far outweigh the negatives. It should be noted that the ECHR is a legal document, not an article of faith, never to be questioned. As times have changed, attitudes have also changed. It is deeply ironic that and historically it's considered to be conservatives that created this law, the legal document the ECHR is, but nowadays progressivism has been more willing to defend the status quo than conservatives, who have been much more willing to question archaic human rights documentation. Judicial expansion is not some unallowed good that is ubiquitously popular. In fact, there is considerable public opinion that indicates that a tightening up of the courts within our own country by the United Kingdom, I'm not referring to Republic of Ireland, I'm not referring to any other European country, is not only a good thing, but is absolutely necessary in developing a robust system of law and order, cutting down on instances of domestic and foreign terror, and setting a high bar for morality and decorum. I want to bring to the forefront of the members of the House's minds the concept of judicial review. The role of the courts in constraining the actions of government needs to be corralled for now and constrained for the future. The activist living instrument interpretation, the ECHR adopted by Strasbourg and transnational human rights Freemasonry, poses a serious threat to the workings of the United Kingdom's democracy and our constitutional documents, although not codified.
On that point.
No, thank you. Another burden of the ECHR on the Constitution and all arrangements of the United Kingdom relate directly to the Northern Ireland Protocol. In 2016, a majority of voters participated in that referendum regarding the United Kingdom's membership of the European Union indicated a desire for Britain to leave, restoring national sovereignty and the ideals of self-determination, despite the fact that 55.8% of the population of Northern Ireland voted to remain. It was a referendum on the entirety of the United Kingdom's membership of the European Union, not Northern Ireland's, not Republic of Ireland's, not any other country.
On that point.
Thank you. However, over the subsequent 6 years, the ECHR has constantly been invoked by overly bureaucratic zealots in an attempt to maintain ties between the United Kingdom, a non-EU state nowadays, and the European Union. The NI protocol has utterly destroyed cohesion between the constituent parts of the United Kingdom, and the ECHR has stood in the way of Westminster being legally able to its own independent affairs. No, thank you. Which is a grave injustice and also deeply undemocratic. In leaving the ECHR and re-establishing its own Bill of Rights, which existed until, I don't know, you tell me, the United Kingdom will be able to restore its parliamentary sovereignty while also providing its own judiciary with the ability to worldwide interpret legislation. to protect its borders and citizens without being answerable to some flawed and cumbersome higher moral power on the European mainland. So, fundamentally, I don't want to portray this as the whole idea concept of Europe being an enemy of Britain, but in terms of centralised power and taking away a country's, a democratic country, might I add,
ability to govern its own affairs. Brussels bureaucracy is detrimental to life as we know it. It is another betrayal of the essence of what it means to be a democratic, self-sustaining country.
On that point.
To conclude, I want to sum up the essence of the points of my argument that I've made so far. Firstly, leaving the European Convention on Human Rights will grant countries the power to deport foreign criminals and terrorists, preventing them from abusing the convention in order to seek refuge and avoid punishment for their abhorrent and horrific actions, not least in light of the September 9/11 attacks and the subsequent anti-Western agenda perpetuated by certain groups. This in turn will protect the law-abiding citizens already resident in the aforementioned country and will give the courts and law enforcement much needed greater discretion and freedom in acting to prevent wanted foreign criminals from entering and potentially exploiting the country constitutionally, fundamentally undermining the moral law and order that has been hard fought to be upheld throughout history. Secondly, the European Convention on Human Rights is not infallible and is in fact a legitimate threat to democracy, not only in the United Kingdom, where the shackles of Brussels bureaucracy have been lifted, but also in other countries burgeoning to regain autonomy over their judicial systems in order to restore sovereignty and fundamental law and order. Finally, by leaving the European Convention on Human Rights, the United Kingdom will be able to mediate the implications of Brexit on trade and free movement of people, etc., on its own terms, without those terms being dictated to Westminster by an outside entity with absolutely no nuanced understanding of the delicate constitutional matters that belie the UK and its citizens and subjects. I hope that I have convinced the House to vote in line with the proposition on this motion. Thank you.
Mr. President, Mr. President Emeritus, Mr. Supreme Chancellor of the Galactic Empire that is the Letterific, members of the Proposition and members of the Opposition and members of the House. It's a pleasure to be here this evening to debate this heavily topical issue. Once again, the timeliness of these debates couldn't be any better, what with the Conservative Party wanting to make attempts for us as the UK to leave the ECHR and create a Bill of Rights in the UK. Firstly, I would like to dispute some of the things that Jamie has said. First of all, the ECHR has nothing to do with the European Union, it's a completely separate entity. Another point about Northern Ireland, if we were to leave the ECHR, we would have to renegotiate the Good Friday Agreement all over again. Now, Northern Ireland is already a political shit show. Would we really want to do that again? I think not. I must say, I'm also excited to debate against my friend Cormac. He and I have had many arguments over the years, and so it's nice to finally do it in an official capacity. So Cormac, best of luck to you, mate, but this is where I'll disperse with the niceties. I'm vehemently opposed to this motion, and I hope to persuade you all to feel the same. The ECHR, whilst not perfect, is better than what the British government have to offer. The opposition are going to use the word could a lot this evening. Now, because there are genuine issues with the ECHR, I wouldn't dispute that, and I doubt any members in the opposition would. It's not perfect. However, we're going to make the case that it's a net positive, and that attempts for the UK to leave the ECHR would firstly be an optical nightmare and an incredibly legally complex thing to do. Now, I'm only a politics student, I have no law background, but it's apparent even to me, this is some fucking messy shit. I have some genuine issues with the ECHR, one major one being that the right to freedom of speech is not a guaranteed absolute right, but I'm going to make the case that it is better for us to remain in the ECHR because it is evident for all of us with eyes to see that the British government as an institution must not and cannot be trusted to make laws regarding human rights in the UK. And I'm going to use a few examples of authoritarian bills that have been passed in the past 2 decades. My laptop is very far away. My first example being the 2003 Communications Act, in particular Article 3, Section 27. It is a law that banned offensive things we said online, and I quote, what it makes illegal is grossly offensive or of an indecent, obscene, menacing character via the use of social media, essentially. Now, this troubles me because of how vague it is. I'll repeat it again. Grossly offensive. Now, what actually constitutes being grossly offensive? I'm sure we all have different definitions. James Orchard, for example, gets offended every single time someone asks Matthew what he's had for breakfast. Although I doubt he would want people in prison for it. Maybe he would, I'm not so sure. Now, I have a problem with laws that make speech illegal. There are many good arguments that you can make for it, but they don't sit well with me, and I don't like where they go. Take China as a prime example. Their censorship laws started from a position of wanting to prevent
offensive speech. It started at the time of the Cultural Revolution, and the aim of that was to get rid of the four olds: old customs, old culture, old habits, and old ideas. If newspapers touched on sensitive topics like these, journalists were often subject to arrest and sometimes violence. Libraries in which there were books containing offensive literature would often be burnt down. Television was regulated, radio was regulated as well, and they played songs such as "The Great Cultural Revolution is Indeed Good." Now, what we can take from that is that the Great Cultural Revolution was good, and if anything else you say is counter-revolutionary speaking, you'll be gulagged. We don't have mass book burnings in the UK, I hope. But we do have people arrested for things that they post online. Take Chelsea Russell for an example. She was a 19-year-old girl from a council estate in Liverpool, and a friend of hers died in a car accident, and so she posted a photo of him and his favourite song lyrics on Facebook or Instagram. The song lyrics in question contained a very naughty word, which I won't repeat, but we all know what that word probably is.
Point of permission. What is the word that I generally don't know?
The N-word. So, Chelsea Russell was arrested and is now a hate criminal because of a tribute she posted to her friend. That was a ridiculous waste of taxpayers' time. And like I said, that was when we were in the ECHR. Imagine the type of chaos that the British government would bring when we leave the ECHR and they're free to do whatever they want. Surveillance is another issue that would become worse if not for the ECHR. The ECHR had to strike down a claim from the UK government that wiretapping was not legal. Spoiler alert, it is. And let's not forget that in 2016, the House of Commons passed the highly controversial Snoopers Charter, and that allowed the security agencies in the UK to spy on WhatsApp to catch out suspected terrorists. Let's not be naive enough to pretend that the Conservatives don't want to leave the ECHR for any other reason other than the fact that they are authoritarians. They want to ship people off to Rwanda, and the ECHR is stopping them from doing that. It's the main reason why. Now, the ECHR isn't perfect, like I've said, but it is a fine check on political governments and political parties, such as the Conservatives, that want to enact more authoritarian social policies.
The ECHR was never designed to be used for individual cases, and only 5% of the cases they have brought forward are actually accepted. So only in certain instances like Rwanda where it's actually taken forward, but the vast majority of cases aren't reported or covered by the ECHR, which means there are hundreds and thousands of people that aren't currently getting support that are needed.
Alright, and say we left the ECHR, imagine how much more they could try and get away with. Now, another thing to mention as well, the new proposed British Bill of Rights doesn't account for abortion. There's no guarantee to birth control.
Oh, not abortion?
No.
Not really
decent. I said no. I dispute the idea that the government should simply leave the ECHR and abandon the 1998 Human Rights Act in exchange for a new Bill of Rights. And if I was speaking with policymakers such as Rishi Sunak, I would encourage him to review and make reforms to legislation that negatively affects freedom of expression, particularly reform of the Official Secrets Act, the proposed Online Safety Bill, which is a very nice and comforting name for what it really is, the government tightening control on the internet and creating censorship. I would like for there to be a removal of anti-surveillance legislation, especially for the Snoopers Charter. Now, if we leave the ECHR, the government can essentially do whatever they want. Like I've said, the Conservative Party themselves, they are authoritarians. What makes you think that they wouldn't suddenly become libertarian the second we leave the ECHR? And I don't particularly see the Labour Party standing up for it either. One of the things with the ECHR, particularly with freedom of expression, is it protects the right to trade unions to assemble. The government is extremely against trade unions. And so I think it's better in our national interest, for our freedom's sake, to stay in the ECHR. I hope you will join the opposition in saying fuck authoritarianism by voting against this motion. Thank you.
Can we have another round of applause for those who made the speech? The second speech proposition is Colin Sparrow.
Hello everybody. Let's make it clear, human rights are a cause that runs deep in this part of the world. From the Magna Carta, which gave rights for citizens, and the necessity, which was ending being unlawfully detained or held, to the Petition of Rights, which installed Parliament with new authority and essentially removed the monarchy's power. Rights, they're not always a straight line, you know, and even the German philosopher Karl Marx said, you know, the move from monarchy to a bourgeois democracy was still in itself progress. And obviously rights have increased and at times they've waned, and you know, much of the opposition's argument is that we could take a step backwards, a type of thing. I dispute these. And all of these human rights have evolved, but a spirit of liberty was what led to all of these, from the abolition of slavery, voting rights, the battle against evil and the world wars. We can't downplay the achievements of the convention or the court after World War II, which is whenever the convention was drafted with the intention of moving from a Europe that was a victim of totalitarian rule, that had witnessed the Holocaust and a world war. Its purpose was to enshrine vital rights across Europe. It of course did achieve some vitally important rights, such as prevention of police brutality, torture, and it held lots of states to account. The question should not be about whether the convention is morally correct or is at times a threat to sovereignty. The question instead should be, should we stick to the status quo, and, or should we ask ourselves, is the convention and its enforcement by the court working? The opposition would have you believe that the only way we can maintain rights is with the convention. They won't mention that of the 47 countries who've signed up to the convention, most of these have failed in protecting these rights. Whether that be migrants or women in Hungary or LGBT people in Poland, it is clear, no thank you, the convention is not up to the task of preserving rights, liberty and the integrity of the people which it was set up to do. We should be talking about how we need a court or a convention which can be a bastion of rights. The convention and the court can currently not claim to do so. And you know, the court is typically presented as having enemies in the UK, who seek to undermine it. The reality is that the court is under siege, not from enemies in the UK or elsewhere. It is in a way a victim of its own successes. The court has several hundred thousand applications pending, and with around 60,000 new cases lodged every year. The court cannot adjudicate on so many cases, it would be impossible. I say victim of its own success because it is compelled to do too much. 60,000 new cases a year is a stark contrast to the fact that within the first 40 years of the court, there were only 45,000 cases brought forward. There can be delays of years before the court can actually hear some of the tens of thousands of people who believe that their rights have been infringed upon. And I'm mentioning the court because that's because of how the convention's implemented. The opposition are absolutely bonkers in their suggestion that a singular court can hear the problems of 800 million European citizens, nor should it even attempt to do so. The convention should in practice be a best scenario that people would go to after national courts have failed. Okay, Daniel, yes.
No harm, but what you're expressing, what you're talking about is in the ideal of how the court works is actually how the court works.
Yes, but no. I'm going to build on that, Daniel. Instead, it shouldn't focus on... No, you're going to hear in a second. And obviously, that would be the way it should be. But instead, they should be focusing on issues of particular gravity and of European-wide importance. When the convention is found to be breached, the body which is meant to oversee the implementation of the court's agreed judgments, the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe, failed to execute the penalties for states that ignore its rulings. Ultimately, the greatest protection of human rights and also preventing an overindulgence with the ECHR is an improvement in the quality of justice and human rights administered in the member states. The court is at times woefully inefficient in that it has many spurious cases that turns into a court of fourth instance. Okay, Ali, go ahead for it.
You're talking about the fact that the court is unsuccessful, which already been brought up.
The court.
But second of all, my actual POI, by saying that the court doesn't do its job and that we'd be better under the Tory government, you have to argue that you agree with what the government will bring instead. Does that mean you support the flights to Rwanda?
Rwanda. Enough of this liberal yapperelli, you know. Let's get on to it. At the end of the day, you know, there were always going to be people protesting the lawyers and all that kind of thing. And obviously, it is a court of fourth instance, but and it's meant to be a sort of one extra last attempt for anyone who's not satisfied with the domestic ruling, even if the domestic court's judgments are reasonable and has been decided in line with the convention. The court's obviously a victim of these spurious cases that have been dealt with at a local or a national level. A very clear example of this is a man brought the Europe, went to the courts saying that his human rights have been infringed upon because he took a bus journey from Madrid to Bucharest and it cost him 90 euros. He brought the company to the ECHR to demand compensation, and one of the reasons he gave was that it wasn't as comfortable as advertised. Now, the litter I think is going on Thursday down to Dublin on a bus. I better hope it has reclining seats, you know. The court cannot deal with the sheer volume of cases, and it even is pushing back victims, because obviously if there's such an overlap of cases, how can it even speak for some of those, say, people who are being like deported from other countries? Like, well, they decided to do that there. So I really doubt that, you know, you can have 800 million people being adjudicated from one court and one convention. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen of the House, I would like to start my speech tonight with a quote. In the centre of our movement stands the idea of a Charter of Human Rights, guarded by freedom and sustained by law. This is a statement by Winston Churchill, a PM at the time the convention was being founded, may I add. So the UK had heavy support when the convention was being made, shortly after the Second World War. The concept of the European Convention on Human Rights was formed because of the atrocities committed during the Second World War, after the mass ethnic cleansing of the Jewish people by the Nazi Party, where roughly 6 million Jewish men, women and children were killed in Nazi Germany. So the European Convention of Human Rights has been put in place not just to protect the rights of all people in the countries that belong to the Council of Europe, but to make sure our countries no longer have the power to dehumanise or abuse people's rights without being held to account and not taking the consequences for their actions. Now, why would we leave this convention after witnessing possibly the biggest crime against humanity ever committed? It is not like the convention itself is outdated and does not apply today, roughly 72 years later. Since 1950, the convention has been amended by further protocols. The last protocol was placed in August 2021, so it's hardly outdated legislation. In fact, it is living legislation. If we look at some of the articles in it as well, I would find it awfully hard for anyone in this room to be against what the convention lays down. For instance, Article 3, prohibition of torture. No one shall be subjected to torture or to inhumane or degrading treatment or punishment. Is anyone in this room against that? Just checking. Or Article 14, prohibition of discrimination. The enjoyment of the rights and freedoms set forth in this convention shall be secured without discrimination on any grounds such as sex, race, colour, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin, association with a national minority, property, birth or other status. I'm going to guess no one is going to argue against that either. In December 2021, the UK government themselves published the Independent Human Rights Act Review, which resulted in a 10-month inquiry into the convention and found an overwhelming body of support for keeping it. Also, public polling more often than not found broad support for the 10 core rights in the Convention of Human Rights in the UK. So if it is not outdated, what are the arguments for removing it if the UK publics themselves support the core beliefs? The only people who gain in removing it would be members of the government, especially members of the executive. Removing the legislation would create an increase in sovereignty to the UK, making the executive far more powerful because they no longer have to follow the convention. The judicial system would be heavily limited if this happened as well, because they would lose scrutiny over the executive, and theoretically an abuse of human rights could occur if it is not being handled properly. So if removing the convention only increases the sovereignty of the executive and could cause serious issues, and the UK public are already satisfied with the current EU convention, what is the point in leaving? Northern Ireland is an example I want to use to stress why it would be easier to maintain the current European convention instead of leaving it as well. If we left the European convention, we would essentially breach the Good Friday Agreement, which requires that the convention be directly enforceable in Northern Ireland. The Good Friday Agreement has a lot of legacy issues surrounding it, and it is a piece of legislation that has been amended before, like with the St Andrews Agreement. However, the Good Friday Agreement was made to enshrine human rights in Northern Ireland because basically any primary legislation passed by the Northern Ireland Assembly is subjected to the European Convention on Human Rights. So the Good Friday Agreement would be a major issue if we left the convention, because effectively the agreement is no longer valid. This potentially means the conflict will start if we leave the convention. And keep in mind, no thank you, and keep in mind, it also would affect devolved government, not just in Ireland, but in Scotland and Wales. So it's not a good idea to leave. To conclude, I believe that the UK citizens themselves are happy with the European, not the European, the European Convention of Human Rights, and leaving the convention would potentially cause far more harm than good, especially in Northern Ireland. Thank you.
Welcome. Oh my God!
Just before I start my speech, this is not me. I'm just playing to a character. Please do nothing to help me. I beg of you, do not take this too seriously. And also, if you're expecting a sound legal argument, I'm sorry, I just wrote this morning. It's shallow. Also, this is what I was supposed to wear for fuck roll. What?
I don't really
see. There you go. Can I start the timer now?
Wait.
Come for us, the Faraj!
Wait, let me breathe for a while. Oh, no, wait. Oh, it's fine.
You're looking sexy.
Oh, don't stop. Let me breathe for. Okay, done. Wait, 3, 2, 1. Honourable members of the House, Lord Emperor, Mr. President, this House will leave the European Convention of Human Rights, or the ECHR. But what is the ECHR, I hear you ask? The ECHR is nothing but a gigantic kraken that was spreading its tentacles of European oppression, twisting and curling, strangling any unsuspecting nation, which I am fortunate enough to be adjacent to Brussels and Strasbourg, while his suction cups are wrapped around the metaphorical balls of the United Kingdom, twisting and twirling as his ball turned from blue to purple to any colour imaginable under the sun. Oh, that's what the UK hard Brexit is for us to believe. No, honourable members, no, Mr. President, that is not the true description of the ECHR. The ECHR is what the name suggests, a convention, piece of paper. What is there to fear of? No, it is not a piece of paper. No. It's not the paper of fear, but the black white in it that fear, dictating what limited rights that we get to practice. This goes again what the arse stand for. Residue freedom. a fundamental of our legal tradition. We are free to do what we please and enjoy our natural birthright without some paper telling us to do it. Mr. President, my argument consists of 3 points. So, arguably 2, but 2 plus 1 if you may. Which are the ECR does not fit our reality, parliamentary sovereignty, common law and the equity, and adopting ECHR is inherently un-British, un-UK to do so. So, how is the ECHR not fit for reality? How does it not fit for purpose? 2 ways. That the ECHR ruling acts as a ceiling and not the floor for development of human rights. And that the ECHR has no teeth. The European Court of Human Rights, or STARS for short, claim to operate under the doctrine of living instruments, which interprets the law, which the international law flows with time. But careful inspection now realize that there are nothing but originalists hiding under a cloth. We're stuck with issue of looting. That's it. There's nothing we can do. So it's game over. We're stuck with it. The UK court is not allowed to go further than the East Asia court as per secondary of the HRA, and the law essentially is frozen in time with no manner of weapon. No, thank you. Yet, the UK court is compelled to declare domestic law to be incompatible with the ECHR as per section 4 of the HRA. Originalism, ruling legal interpretation since the 1980s. Good stuff. After all that, the ECHR itself does not have the mechanism to force offending members to implement their rulings. So, not only were we not allowed to offer a different light regarding human rights, but we are also left empty-handed when it comes to enforcement. No thank you. The same goes, one man's trash and another man's treasure. Same applies here. One man's freedom is an infringement of another's right. There needs to be a strike of balance, and under the ECHR, there is no balance! And sooner or later, everything under the sun will be detected by ECHR. There will be no grounds for challenge. Tell me, how many cases that reached the staff were actually challenged previous rule? None! Absolutely none! The court certain one-seat wonder, Jay Mallister, We are subjecting ourselves to a new era of colonialism, and we are the colony. Point two, having the ECHR reign above domestic statutory law is itself against parliamentary sovereignty, the common law, and equity. Unique to the US, the parliament reigns supreme. It is the sole life-giver and undertaker of laws. The ECHR presents a blunder to this idea of supremacy, as amending the ECHR requires enormous agreement to all signatories. A law that cannot be altered by Parliament alone. What witchcraft is this? Heresy, I say! Parliament conversely can swiftly respond to changing public needs. In theory! Okay, where was I? In theory. But now you may ask, what if Parliament goes rogue and acts against public interest and human rights? That's when common law and equity steps in. Even though Parliament is so live lawmaker, this there is only for statutory law. Equity, common law and equity, on the other hand, is a creature of the courts. I know this is all A-level stuff, but as Lord Danny Master Rowe once put it, judges work in mysterious ways, which stands contrast to ECHR's originalist agenda. The common law and equity is far more superior in terms of development law. Common equity fills the gaps of the existing law. It challenges the unthinkable loops left by Parliament, and it complements and rounds off the rough edges of the law. Something that the Strasbourg would never be able to see. Now, how can I make such bold claims to say? The UK, especially, or more specifically, the jurisdiction of England and Wales, has always served as a prime venue for dispute resolution. Some might choose Singapore, some might go Delaware. But why does none of our civil court tradition, like France and Germany, or even neutral countries like Switzerland or Austria? This only serves to bolster that an undeniable fact that common law and equity are superior for law development. Applying the same logic, instead of being blindly towed by the ECHR, common law and equity should be the basis of human rights protection. And finally, adopting the ECHR itself is inherent, un-British, un-UK. I'm sure history and politics students may be aware of the traditional British pastime of making up laws and forcing, having others to implement it. Need an example? The Northern Ireland Planning Act, 2011. Inspired by the Westminster counterpart. Companies Act found around the Commonwealth country, which like Malaysia and Singapore, basically a carbon copy of the UK Companies Act 26. You don't believe me? Check out Companies Act 26 for yourself. Instead of having Europeans dictating what Brits can do and can't do, we should be telling the Europeans what to do. Borrowing from the previous point, the common law system does things best. Be gone with the ECHR, and in comes the Commonwealth Convention of Human Rights. Okay, I'm going to do a joke point anyway. Many of you may be aware of this society's rich tradition in the musicals. Classics like The Debating Queen, the Leave the Room, a literary rap. And who could forget? The goal of C.S. Lewis asks you to fuck off. Allow me to participate in such tradition of borrowing the last lines from pop and singer sounds to really drive home the message. I can't believe I'm doing this. This is a quick joke. Alright, here goes. God who made thee mighty.
Team.
human rights, mighty earth. A wicked door in the patriotism. A vote for proposition is a vote for the union and a vote for the future of human rights. Thank you.
The struggle I have tonight in this debate is a lot of things that I'm going to take apart one by one. First of all, I want to take apart the aspect that it's un-British and undemocratic, as basically things that have been propositioned by the Tory government for years, and it's not true whatsoever. And then I'm also going to examine what would realistically actually replace the Human Rights Act, aka the HRA, which is a bill that the Tory government proposed, which is called the Bill of Human Rights. I will also explain what the convention actually does, because it hasn't been explained very well tonight. So basically what happened was the ECHRA basically came about, and what it meant was it wasn't in domestic law, so you couldn't really bring it through the UK courts. The Human Rights Act changed that. It basically instilled the rights of the ECHRA into actual British law, which meant that, unlike what the second speaker has claimed, that you can't, that most cases with the ECHRA go through domestic courts first, and then if the person is not happy with that decision, they can go to the European Court of Human Rights.
That's a clarification.
Go for it.
So, I mentioned the examples of Abu Hamza and Abu Qatada. They never went through UK courts. They invoked the European Convention on Human Rights directly, saying that they were being discriminated against by extradition. That does not invoke UK legislation. That is
right. So essentially, how it works is it's an option. So essentially, you can either go through the domestic courts or you can go through the European court directly. And essentially, if the European court deems that something is not right, then they have to take that argument. What I'm going to do is I also want to, the un-British European ECHR was actually supported by us, and we were one of the founding members of it, and it was also supported by Winston Churchill. And it's also completely separate from Europe, has nothing to do to Europe, it just has Europe in the name. So, and also people are arguing like, oh, what has the ECHR done for us? Oh well, I have examples and plenty of them. So, successful uses of the Human Rights Act, which is kind of after the ECHRA, incorporates everything from anti-discrimination cases to cases that revolve around the right to life. For example, between 2005 and 2008, record mortality rates at a general hospital were higher, and patients also experienced low standards of care. And using HRA, which hold public bodies responsible for investigating deaths and mistreatment at the hands of the state, a full public inquiry was launched. It resulted in a wide-ranging reforms to the NHS. Now, in the early 1980s, homosexuality was still a crime in Northern Ireland. This was raised to the European Court of Rights, which then deemed it as an infringement of that person's rights. which led to homosexuality being decriminalised in Northern Ireland. So let's continue on. Also, it also led to, so the UK government once had a law, well, rules in the military, that you could be kicked out of the military for being gay. Happened to two people. It was then challenged in the European Court of Rights, and that rule was removed entirely, and it meant that gay people could serve for their country. And there's so many more, like protection of religious rights, like a woman who actually went to European Court of Rights because she wasn't allowed to wear a cross in her uniform, which led to wide-reaching changes of that. There's also in terms of disabilities in the UK. Oh, I can go on. So now, in the current system, if you feel like you've had your rights violated on the ECHR, you can file a claim in the UK courts, or if that fails, you can go right up to European Court in Strasbourg. As you can see, there have already been cases where the UK believe that there have been no infringement on human rights, such as the case with that woman who wore a cross. They actually argued that she wasn't allowed to wear that cross with her uniform, and that went to the European Court of Rights, and they basically told the UK to go do one. So the UK can get it wrong, and the European Court basically acts as a
point of clarification.
No, the European.
No, I. Is it actually a point of clarification?
Exactly. The last one wasn't like.
If you actually want your clarification, I will let you have it, and I will pause the time whilst you have it.
Okay.
So you've quoted absolutely nothing to do with what are the ECHR's field. You've focused purely on instances.
That's not a point of clarification.
That is. I'm clarifying your argument. You're arguing something without referencing.
A point of clarification is about a particular quote.
If someone says that you said and they misrepresent what you said, that's what point of clarification is for.
So. Oh, no worries. The failures now. So essentially, one of the failures is this idea that the European Court has so many cases I can't possibly handle them all. Yeah, I've said basically the people do go through domestic courts first before they go up to the European Court. Second of all, most of the complaints that some countries don't listen to the European Court, most of them are fun countries like Turkey and Russia. Russia left last year. So now the third thing I'm going to say is that it has actually led to with the European Court, they've essentially said, here, this is not okay, UK, and it has caused legislative change. Now, another point that they say is that it's undemocratic and infringes on sovereignty. No, it doesn't. I'm going to explain why. So essentially, at the moment, the UK courts, what they can do is they can get a piece of legislation and interpret it so it benefits human rights, kind of, with the ECHR. But what they fail to mention, which is very important, is they cannot do this to the point where it changes the meaning of an act of parliament. The courts legally can't. There's literally two things which they can't do it with. They can't do it if it significantly changes the legislation. So say an act of parliament was raised that said that it was banned for people to go to this thing. The UK High Courts can't completely change the meaning of it. And they also can't change the meaning of it when it would mean like massive, massive changes in how the country is run. In that case, they propose something called a statement of incompatibility. That's all they can do. That is all they can do. Then what typically happens is it is then the parliament's job to essentially go, okay, we agree with them and we'll change the law bit, or they are allowed as an act of sovereignty to keep the act as it is. So the act of sovereignty argument and all this lot jaws, load of nonsense. Anyway, that's my speech tonight. Have fun.
We now move to questions from the House. So do we have any questions for the proposition?
Thanks so much.
There you go.
Okay. So, earlier, you QI'd that the ECHR doesn't mention abortion, and I find it funny that three men telling me that it doesn't mention abortion when Article 8 has been used. You can look it up yourself. Article 8, which refers to the private life, has been used in cases of abortion to protect the woman's right to choose, including her partner, which it does then clarify under the ECHR that abortion rights are clarified under the ECHR, and you have to argue what the alternative to the ECHR is, which I haven't really heard once from you, which is the Bill of Rights by the Tories. The Bill of Rights by the Tories, which has been introduced so far, does not mention once a woman's right to guarantee an abortion, B, her right to contraception, or C, her right to bodily autonomy, which represents then a misjudgment in women's issues. So are you proposing to leave the ECHR, and also you've been fact-checked there on the abortion, and go with the Bill of Rights, which doesn't guarantee a woman's right to choose?
Can we split this up?
No, it has to be one response only for each side.
Okay. See, right, the ECHR is not the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights that was drawn up in the immediate aftermath of World War II. The ECHR is a document that is not objective. The United Nations Declaration of Human Rights is. There is no such mention of the word abortion in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. It can be interpreted, however, that reproductive rights it can be made to fit the context of the time, and well, there is no explicit
clarification, please.
Legislation says abortion is a right.
If it's clarifying something that's misrepresented that you've said, then yes.
So in Article 8, it has been used for the ECHR, Article 8 has been used to guarantee a woman's right to abortion and choose because it, yes, it was interpreted that way, but it does not language of
abortion.
Okay, opposition to respond.
Evo v. France, number 5,
opposition to respond.
Right, so essentially, what is an actual interesting aspect of the EHR that hasn't been actually talked about tonight is its ability to adapt to new times. There's a specific provision in the ECHR that basically means it can adapt as it goes along. And the second thing that is a point that needs to be talked about, I didn't have time to talk about, so I'm fine. Thank you so much for bringing it up, is the proposed Bill of Human Rights that's proposed by the government. So the first thing that they want to impose is that you have to prove significant damage when you file a claim with the court, which means that inevitably, and with no kind of big daddy European Court of Human Rights to basically tell them to shut up, that means that some cases will inevitably slip through the cracks of human rights abuse. And it also means that at the moment, the European Court of Human Rights has essentially a thing that they can use. It's kind of like an emergency power that they can use when there is like immediate danger to someone's human rights or their life, which was used in the case of the plane to Rwanda. That would be completely removed. At this moment, it is paused until they see if the action is compatible with human rights or not. If the UK had their way, they wouldn't have that thing anymore. Also, it removes the proactive kind of rights that public authorities have to agree to, which have been used in the past by the CHR to basically call out the government and or public authorities bad actions in cases like the Hillsborough disaster and the Black Hat rapist incident, where the police failed to investigate the attacks properly. Also, a lot of fun stuff to do with deportation of foreign criminals, very fun. Yeah. Thank you for giving me a chance to bring it up.
Any questions for the opposition? I'm going to give it to you.
So I feel like a lot of time has been spent by the opposition, particularly Keir's speech, saying what the court can do and how it is weak, but whilst also arguing for European continental human rights. Wouldn't you agree that we'd be better off leaving the framework of the court as it stands today and creating a more powerful institution, given that so much time has been devoted to explaining what it can't do.
Opposition to respond.
Yeah, that's the ideal situation, but realistically that won't happen. Because at this point in time, essentially we are kind of the European Court of Rights is the big daddy that we have to listen to, right? And at the moment, what would happen if we left the ECHR is that the trade agreement between us and Europe would be infringed upon, so that we no longer have access, not the whole agreement, I know, but essentially rights to securities with Europe. Also, another thing is that the UK government basically wants to leave this so that they can impose something like the Bill of Rights, which I have said, and it's kind of pointless as well, because the Bill of Rights literally has most, if not all, of the rights already in the ECHR. It just makes them far more difficult to actually enforce in day-to-day life. So, and the Supreme Court all has the power to basically go to provide a statement of non-compatibility, so they do have the power to do that as well.
Proposition to respond.
Yes, I do agree with keeping it, because again, the ECHR has some teeth, and coming back to the implementation, not implementing judgment, the UK is actually quite a good defender of that. Like, for example, like prison voting, and I can't remember one day, suicide, like, we did not care. Even the ECHR say, oh no, we have to do that, and we just say, no, we don't. And the second part of the ECHR, the Declaration of Incompetence, is actually more damning than the ECHR itself, because, again, it goes against parliamentary sovereignty. The fact that parliament is sovereign, that parliament is law. And then you now call the community and say, yeah, no, that's not law. Which is against parliamentary. That's why we have common law and equity. Common law equity is the bread for the soup. So we want that because it complements it. It actually fills in the gap of parliament that's empty. And the third point is the proposed Bill of Rights. Proposed Bill of Rights actually depends on the ECHR. This motion is part of leaving the ECHR. How are you going to implement the proposed Bill of Rights when you already left the ECHR? That's my point. And just it for one moment.
Any abstention questions, which is neither a question to the proposition or the opposition, and definitely not one aimed slightly at one side more than the other. Daniel McCormick.
Right, so both these at different times, both sides have described the sort of function and the way that the court human rights work. And both of you described it wrong. One said it right first, then the other said it wrong in response. And how can you seriously get me to believe, either way, as someone who's politically neutral at all times, but whenever I'm considering either argument, you're talking about the sort of the functionality of this document, you're talking about the manifestation of it in active law. How can you possibly convince anyone of the veracity of your argument when you clearly don't understand what you're talking about enough to describe it accurately this evening?
Typical law student. Proposition to respond. Quickly as well, because we're short for time.
So, the Good Friday Agreement you brought up with the ECHR. looking at this objectively, whether loyalists, Republicans, prisoners, people committed murders, either claimed political acts or whatever, we gave the amnesty to that to secure peace. Now, people are saying the ECHR is this paradigm to go off, but you basically have to put like 30 years of Northern Irish history to effectively be so oblivious to the fact that the ECHR is staying and how it's been used. So,
opposition to respond.
Right, so I'll respond with my basic gist of how the act works. Please tell me if I'm wrong. So essentially, the ECHR at first was essentially a treaty that most of the nations agreed to. At the start, it was international law, it wasn't domestic law, which meant that you couldn't raise it for the UK courts. Now, that changed in 1998 or 1999 with the Human Rights Act, which the ECHR into domestic law. which meant that you could use the ECHR in cases in domestic lawsuits. And then if you weren't happy with the judgment in domestic courts, you could then go to appeal and go to the European Court of Human Rights. Now, at the moment, the public authorities and public sector bodies have to oblige to it. So they essentially have to take proactive steps to maintain human rights. The only thing that gets a wee bit iffy is Acts of Parliament. So, with Acts of Parliament, essentially, the UK courts have an authority to basically, all they can do is they can basically go, oh, it's a statement of incompatibility, which means it's not compatible, which triggers in things that usually means that the law gets changed to be compatible, but they don't have to. Then, oh god, there's so much.
We don't have time, unfortunately. Yeah,
then it also gives them, so in cases where it's not explicit in the act, to basically weigh their judgments in favour of what's in the ECHRA. So say it doesn't explicitly say in an act that it's heterosexual couples, that it's only for heterosexual couples, they will then go, oh, it can be applied to homosexual relationships as well, which was actually used in a case of it. And that's essentially what it is. But they cannot do it to the point where they change the act completely or when it would cause massive, massive change in domestic policy and how the country is run.
Right. We now move to the vote on speaker ability, and this is on your opinion on the motion and not your opinion on the motion, but who you thought spoke best. So if you think that the proposition spoke best in tonight's debate, please raise your hand now. Nine. And if you thought that the opposition spoke best in tonight's debate, please raise your hand now.
I'm not a lawyer and I tried, okay? It's so complicated. I had to consult a lawyer and he didn't tell me.
How much do you need? And if you'd like to abstain on tonight's motion, please raise your hand. Josie, can we please have the result?
Yes. My vote is for the proposition, 22 votes for the opposition, and 11 abstentions for the proposition.
Now, before you all get up and leave, obviously, if you're yet to sign up for the bus service to go to our debate in Dublin, please do that. Other than that, go to the pub, speak us to the front for a photo, and that's me done.